Welcome to this special edition of the Onc Live On Air podcast. I'm your host, Jason Harris. Our guest today is Dr. Brian Drucker, director of the Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University and the 2013 Giants of Cancer Care Award winner in leukemia. He began his research career at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in the 1980s, studying why some formerly normal cells shift into overdrive, producing tumors. He would go on to identify the compound that ultimately became imatinib, better known as Gleevec, and demonstrated that the tyrosine kinase inhibitor killed leukemia cells without harming normal cells. Imatinib was a revolutionary development. Clinical trials were so successful that the drug received the fastest approval in FDA history for the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia. CML, once a fatal disease, is now a manageable condition. The agent has since been approved for use in multiple forms of cancer, including pediatric CML. The insights gained from the development of imatinib helped lay the groundwork for other labs to develop treatments for imatinib-resistant CML, as well as the TKIs vimorafenib, erlotinib, gefitinib, and crizotinib. Dr. Drucker also helped to develop ponatinib, which is now approved for the treatment of patients with CML or Philadelphia chromosome-positive acute lymphoid leukemia. In addition to the Giants of Cancer Care Award, Dr. Drucker has earned a long list of accolades during his career, including the Solberg Prize from the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, the Tang Prize in Biopharmaceutical Science, and the Lasker DeBakey Award for Clinical Medical Research. His colleagues have elected him to the National Academy of Medicine, the National Academy of Sciences, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Today, Dr. Drucker tells us why awards don't matter, how becoming a family man has made him a better physician and scientist, and why a doctor should never tell a patient to be patient.
So just to start at the beginning, did you always have a plan to go into medicine?
You know, if I was being honest with myself, I wanted to be a doctor from a pretty young age. I grew up in a family of four, and I was the youngest of four. And there was always a hope and an expectation that one of the four kids would be a doctor, and I turned out to be the last hope. But I always had some sort of a little bit of an aptitude for science and math, and it was just always something that fascinated me. And it was something that I, as I said, if I was honest with myself, I wanted to be a doctor at a pretty young age.
I know you like taking stuff apart. Did you ever consider becoming an engineer or maybe a demolitionist?
Yeah, my problem, that's why I'm not a surgeon, is I'm really good at taking things apart and figuring out how they work. I can't put them back together to save my life. So being an engineer, so one of my math teachers said to me, if you ever build a bridge, let me know so I don't drive over it. But I think he was saying that to the kids who weren't as good at math as I was. But again, I'm really good at putting things back together.
Taking stuff apart is always more fun. So,
yes, it is.
In your medical career, had you always planned to do clinical research, or were you looking more at becoming a clinician? How did you wind up where you are here today?
I always imagined that I would include research, clinical care, and some teaching into my career. And I never kind of planned out what that path would look like. I do remember that when I was starting my laboratory career, 4 or 5 years into it, I was sitting in the lab doing some pretty typical basic research studies on a weekend day. And I was thinking to myself, why did I get an MD when I'm doing things that only a PhD would do? And I realized that I really needed to keep my clinical skills intact. So I picked up a 1 day a week clinic in addition to my laboratory studies so that if I ever wanted to run a clinical trial, that I would have my clinical skills intact. So I was deliberate about ensuring that I had the opportunity to run a clinical trial if I ever was going to. But I never set out to say, I'm going to do a clinical trial. I just wanted to make a contribution. And if that was identifying a drug, a compound, a new way to treat people, I would have been fine with that. It was just a real bonus that I actually got to do something that came out of my lab and into the clinic to a clinical trial.
This is when you were back at Boston at Dana-Farber?
This was at Dana-Farber, yes.
So I know you were there as an instructor and you had a stable position. And at one point they declined to promote you to an assistant professor. So that must have stung. You've been there for a while. But do you think that setback helped you get to where you are today?
It absolutely did sting. And it was perhaps one of the lowest points in my career to be told that somebody you respected and somebody who was a prominent scientist, that they didn't think you had a future. That hurt incredibly hard. But as you indicated, it also was a big boost, meaning there's sometimes when you kind of need a kick in the pants or a slap in the face to just propel you a little bit. And so at that point, I had a choice, you know, do I believe this person who didn't think I had a future, or do I believe in myself? And what that really helped me do is it helped me find an extra gear. And as I think back, I was maybe working at 90% of my capacity, and 90% of my capacity was still pretty good and still competitive with my colleagues. But finding that extra gear and taking it up to 100 to 110% and giving me focus when I left Dana-Farber for a new job. And my focus now was find a drug company that had a drug that would inhibit leukemia cells and get that drug into clinical trials. And I was laser focused on that when I left Dana-Farber. And that was that really helped me find that extra gear. So I've never sent a thank you note to the person who told me I didn't have a future, but I do credit, you know, the fact that I was able to recover, that I was able to use that as a positive, and to use that to propel myself to just a different level was essential.
Did you ever gloat? Like, did you send the FDA approval to that person just to show that they were wrong and you accomplished something?
No, again, it was, I think, you know, you can say that as far as I'm concerned, the reality is that just having done some good is good enough, and I don't need to do a victory lap.
So eventually that's the compound that became imatinib, Gleevec. Kind of take me through the process of how you wound up getting to FDA approval. Obviously, you saw something and designed a clinical trial and went from there.
Right. So when I arrived at Oregon Health Science University in Portland, Oregon, I had already established a collaboration with a scientist at Ceva Geigy, which ultimately became Novartis, and that was Nick Leiden. Within 6 weeks arriving in Oregon, he sent me compounds. I started testing them in my laboratory models that I established of chronic myeloid leukemia. And there were a couple of compounds, one in particular that really stood out at killing leukemia cells without harming normal cells. And that compound turned out to be imatinib. Now, you think, okay, the company would say, wow, this looks great, let's get it into clinical trials. The problem was that nobody had ever tested a kinase inhibitor in humans, and there were concerns about toxicity. There were also concerns that it might not work. There were concerns that this unknown investigator out in Oregon that nobody ever heard of might not be worth a risk. But the death knell was the market potential. And if you did a market analysis, it would cost about $1 billion to develop the drug, and the return on that investment might be at the most, they calculated, $100 million a year. And so they figured the drug had maybe a 1 in 10 chance of success and a 0% chance of ever making them a profit. So why would you ever develop a drug like that? So that was where things stood in kind of the 1996 to 1998 era. And there was a lot of heavy lifting to do to convince the company that it was ultimately worth testing in clinical trials.
How did you convince Novartis to save the drug and ultimately bring it to market?
Yeah, so there were a couple of key elements. And what I've talked a little bit about decision-making, you know, the analogy I use is, I wish I'd been a father back then, because I have a little bit of understanding of decision-making. And if you have children, if you ask your kids, what would you like for dinner? The answer usually is, I don't know, what have we got?
Right.
But if you ask your kids, would you like pizza or a hamburger? They can make a decision. And sometimes a decision I don't want either, but nine times out of 10, they can make a decision. And as I look back at my approach to Novartis, I would often ask them an open-ended question of, why aren't you developing this drug? And I get all sorts of excuses, kind of like, well, I don't know what I want for dinner. What have you got? And so again, this open-ended question just wasn't getting answered. During this time, Nick Leiden had left Novartis and started his own biotech company. And Nick was actually prepared to license the compound from Novartis. And that actually allowed a very simple decision to be made or to be put in front of Novartis. Would you license this compound out to a biotech company, or would you move it into phase one clinical trials? That's a binary decision. And so when that question got put to Novartis, they decided that they wanted to run a very small, limited scale phase one trial, in part because they didn't want to give up any royalties if the drug happened to be successful. So having made that decision, we did something I think was quite remarkable, which is we ran a phase one trial, a first in human, that was limited to patients with chronic myeloid leukemia. And that was actually a first in oncology. Typically a phase one trial, you treat all comers with refractory disease and you look for a safety signal. What we were doing is we were saying the people most likely to respond to this treatment were people with CML, and we could run both a safety and efficacy trial wrapped into one phase one trial and get a very early readout in 50 patients, whether this drug was gonna work or not. And that was a remarkable decision and ultimately propelled the speed of this drug toward FDA approval.
So this is a phase one trial. It's the first trial you'd ever led. You developed this agent, you put a lot on the line to get it in the trial. Were you concerned what it meant to your career if it didn't work?
It was a pretty bold move. And my view was, and I just dragged the largest drug company in the world into a clinical trial. And if it didn't work, it absolutely would kill my ability to ever run another clinical trial. But I was confident enough that the only reason this drug wasn't going to work is if it had toxicity, meaning it wasn't tolerated. I was confident enough that from what I saw from the laboratory studies I was running, that if we could get to doses that were tolerable, that it really should work. So I was pretty confident in this compound.
So when did you know you had a breakthrough?
It was pretty early, and it was 6 months into the trial. Everybody was responding, their blood counts were returning to normal. And these were people who had been told, there's nothing left to do, get your affairs in order. Their blood counts, a normal white blood count would be 5 to 10,000. Their blood counts were up in the 50 to 100,000. And they hadn't seen a normal white blood count in years. And within 4 to 6 weeks, their white blood count was normal and they were feeling great. Now, the problem was, at that point, it was like, for me, it was walking on eggshells, because I thought we had something, but what if it lasted only a month or two? And that wouldn't be very useful. And so I was thinking, okay, I've got to wait. It's got to be 3 months. I need 4 months. I need 6 months. But my patients were way ahead of me. I had patients who'd come into clinic early on and they'd say, Doc, I have my hope for the future restored. I feel great for the first time in years. I'm thinking about buying a new car. I'm thinking about going on a vacation that we never thought we'd get to take. I'm beginning to plan for the future again. And my patients were so far ahead of me in embracing this as something that was remarkable that I just had to get on board with them. They brought me along.
So this is your first trial. It's almost like a rookie quarterback coming in and winning a Super Bowl. Did you think they would always be this easy, that you know every clinical trial you brought up would eventually lead to a breakthrough drug?
No, I had complete and full appreciation that this was a once in almost a generational type of a clinical trial. And I never had a view that it was always going to be this easy.
So today, obviously, you've continued your research career. What are you working on now?
I was listening to a talk a decade or so ago, given by the president of ASCO. And he was talking about imatinib or Gleevec. And he was saying, well, Brian chose a really stupid cancer. But he didn't mean any offense to me. I think he was actually complimenting me on choosing a stupid cancer to test targeted therapies, because that was where it was most likely to work. And that's a smart choice. What his point was is that CML is driven by one molecular abnormality, whereas most advanced cancers are driven by a multitude of molecular abnormalities. So I think what he was doing is he was challenging me to work on a much tougher cancer, like acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, where we know it's driven by multiple molecular abnormalities. And if you're really going to see an impact, you need to think about how you combine treatments to try to get more durable responses, less resistance. And that's what we're working on now, is we're working on applying targeted therapy paradigm to a much more complicated cancer like AML. But the other thing we're working on is, when I've talked about the success of imatinib, I've said it really required two elements. One was matching the right patient with the right drug, but also treating earlier in the course of the disease. And because of that, we've turned our attention at our cancer institute to trying to identify cancers at earlier stages where we think they'll be more treatable and more curable. So those are the two things we're working on.
So looking at the broader field of research in leukemia, what's got you excited for the future?
And what's got me excited are the continued evolution of technology. And when I started out my laboratory career, sequencing one gene was a remarkable feat. And now we can sequence a whole genome in days and get the data in weeks. We can analyze the immune profile of cancers. We can analyze the expression profile. We can look at the tumor microenvironment in ways that we never thought possible. So the ability to combine massive amounts of data to make a treatment decision, the likes of which we've never seen before in my career. And that to me is what's exciting, is the ability to generate and analyze data and to use that data to make treatment decisions. I think that's what's going to propel us forward to a much better future for cancer patients.
A few years ago, the FDA allowed some patients with CML to come off of targeted treatment. Do you think we'll get to that place with other leukemias and lymphomas, or are they so much more complicated that we won't see that?
My hope is that, much like CML was a paradigm for targeted therapies, it's also going to be a paradigm for how we get people from remission to cure. And that's also, we have a small project in my lab looking at that. What allows some cells to persist, and how do we eradicate them so we really can affect a cure? And if we can figure that out in CML, I think we can apply that paradigm to other cancers.
So switching gears a little bit, last year, along with Dennis Lehman at UCLA, you won the Solberg Prize. Do prizes matter? Would you feel any different about your career if you hadn't won all the accolades you've received?
You know, Jason, I feel like I'm the luckiest person in the world, and that awards make absolutely no difference in that respect. At least once a week or maybe once a month, I'll get an email out of the blue, and it'll be typically start off with, "Dear Dr. Drucker, you don't know me, but I was just diagnosed with CML, and I want to thank you for saving my life." How could you imagine a reward greater than that? But even bigger than that, I have patients in my clinic now 20 years starting on the phase one clinical trial of imatinib. And in those 20 years, I've seen their hope for the future restored. But not only have I seen that, I've seen what they've done with 20 years, how many life events they've witnessed, the birth of children, grandchildren, kids graduating from college, kids getting jobs. They're just doing all the things that they thought that they'd never get to do. And so I get to see 20 years of additional life through their eyes. And that's just, it's just a remarkable reward. And that's why I feel so incredibly fortunate.
You've been mentioned as a candidate for a Nobel. Would you still be as sanguine about awards if you pick up one of those? Or?
It's just not that, it's not what drives me. Again, there, you can't take away the personal impact that this has had on myself and on the patients that have benefited.
When you started your career in research, I've read that you were sort of a medical hermit. You were in the lab 16 hours a day, and your wife kind of came along and saved you from that. So how do you spend your, now that you have free time, how do you choose to spend it these days?
Well, with three kids, it keeps me pretty busy, although one off in college. But it does keep me really busy, and I spend most of my spare time with my family. Try not to miss any major events, soccer games, basketball games, track meets, whatever they're doing. I try to be there, and we always try to have dinner together as a family and try to take some fabulous vacations. So that's really my outlet these days.
So earlier you mentioned that if you'd been a father when you were first developing imatinib, you probably would have handled it differently, you know, giving Novartis a binary choice. So how does that play into your work today?
You know, I just think that having a family, having children, makes me a much better person, a little bit more patient, a little bit more tolerant, a little bit more accepting of differences. And so I just hope that's helped to round me out and to perhaps mellow me out a little bit. There's more to life than my work, and I'm again incredibly fortunate for that as well.
Do you feel like it's made you a better physician and scientist?
Yeah, I do. I think it's helped ground me. It's helped me understand. You know, one of the famous stories I'll tell about my wife is I was giving a talk and somebody got up and was asking about, oh, this Gleevec sounds great. What are you doing in colon cancer? And I talked about how difficult research is, how long it takes, and we just have to be patient. And I got home and my wife said, well, you gave a nice talk, but don't ever tell a patient to be patient, you idiot. You know, again, it just reminds me that it's all about patience. And we have to work harder, faster to accelerate our progress, because there are still too many patients dying of cancer every single day. And it's 600,000 a year in the United States. We have to do better. We have to get better treatments. We have to diagnose earlier. We just have to think about what we can do to change those numbers. And so I think that's helped me, and my family has helped me focus on what's really important in life.
Speaking of reducing death tolls, in COVID, we just got one vaccine approved. We should probably have a second one approved later on this week. How has the pandemic affected your work in Oregon? Has it affected the school at all or what you do?
Jason, much like the rest of the world, we've suffered through 3 months of shutdown, 300,000 deaths in our country. It's just an absolute tragedy to see what's happened. It certainly has slowed down our work, but there is currently nothing out there that's more dangerous and more in need of attention. But you know, I have to say what a triumph for science. And think about the first mRNA vaccine in the entire world coming along in 9 months from the time of the sequencing of the virus to its FDA approval. That's a testament to the power and the capabilities of technology and science. And what a remarkable breakthrough to get that vaccine out in 9 months. And now we're seeing people getting vaccinated today. And again, I think that's just a remarkable view of what we can accomplish with support of science. Ultimately, that's just a bit of a glimmer of hope as we're facing just horrible, horrific numbers in this country.
You mentioned how fast the mRNA vaccine came together. Do you think that will play a role in cancer care at some point?
Oh, it absolutely has a potential role to think about. Could we stimulate the immune system? And that's actually one of the reasons this mRNA technology and platform was developed. So to think that we actually can see it working for a vaccine, stimulating immune response, we absolutely can use that approach for cancer.
Finally, do you still run to work every day?
Well, the pandemic has changed my commute pretty significantly. It's my commute now is bedroom to office, kitchen to office. So I've had to figure out how to integrate runs into my daily routine a little bit more effectively, because it used to be I'd run back and forth to work, so it was just part of my regular work day. Now I actually have to plan that time. And so now my typical work day is more of an 8 to 4, and I'll go out for a run between 4 to 5 and then come back and help with dinner and have dinner with the family.
You could just jog down to the office and call it a day.
Yes, I could, but it doesn't really accomplish the fitness goals.
It's true, but you protect your knees better that way.
Yes, you do.
So, all right. Well, Dr. Drucker, those are the questions I had for you. But is there anything else you want to add? And then I'll let you go.
Well, Jason, I appreciate you getting on. I think we've covered quite a lot of territory.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for coming on today. I really appreciate your time.
That's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Brian Drucker, and thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive's State of the Science Summit and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.